Yeah, there actually is a market. There's something called a marketization index. If you go to our website, you know, the freetheworld.com website, you'll and if you click under other economic freedom indexes or something like that, there is a list of economic freedom indexes that have been constructed for subnational units. There's one for like the states of Argentina, one for the states of India, one for the states of Italy, but there's also, and of course, one for the United States and Canadian provinces. But there's also one for China, and it's called a marketization index. And it's been probably 4 or 5 years since I really looked at the details on it. But they basically are trying to do some kind of a economic freedom index for the Chinese provinces. They call it a marketization index because, as you might already figure out, calling it an economic freedom index is politically incorrect in Chinese politics. So, but calling it a marketization index is apparently okay. So, you might want to look at that report. I think there is a translation in English. I'm not sure. At least there was plans. There, last I heard, there was plans to have one. But I honestly haven't followed the project too closely. WebEx thing, so I'd pull. Okay, good afternoon or evening, everybody. Welcome back from Dallas here. Before I get going, I just want to say it's a really good thing that the World Series isn't on tonight, because if the Texas Rangers were playing tonight, we would have had to cancel this session and do it some other time. But luckily, this is a travel day, so we're free to keep going. I must say I've enjoyed the little chat conversation about the various technical standards. I'm kind of a Luddite when it comes to e-reading. I still use books for the most part, but like everybody else, I'm going to eventually jump and buy a Kindle or a Nook or whatever. As far as the Mises Institute thing goes, I must say I have probably purchased a dozen copies of Jeff Tucker's Bourbon for Breakfast. It's become sort of a stocking stuffer for me. I give it to friends. It's a fun little book, and if you haven't looked at that yet, I do encourage you to read it. Again, good evening. We're going to talk tonight about economic freedom and economic growth. And this is probably the most technical of all the lectures I have planned for you all. I've got it boiled down to a fairly layperson's standard here, so hopefully I won't lose anybody. If you've had a background in statistics or econometrics, it probably helps, but it's not necessary. So, but hopefully we'll be able to you know, not lose anybody. If you have any questions along the way, please feel free to put them up, and we'll try to take them at the end. All right. So, you know, in the last class, we introduced the Economic Freedom of the World Index. And if you remember, the main objective, the main motivation for creating the index was to create some kind of quantitative scoring of how much economic freedom or market orientedness or whatever term you want to use exists in a country, so that we could investigate empirically whether and how much economic freedom matters in terms of economic output, growth, other social outcomes. By far, the most studied area with economic freedom has been economic freedom and economic growth, which is a little bit of a surprise, because when Milton Friedman and Michael Walker at the Fraser Institute and Walter Block at the Fraser Institute, when they set out to start, you know, with the idea of creating an economic freedom index that Jim Courtney and I eventually took up, they were really interested in the relationship between economic freedom and political democracy, political freedom, freedom of speech, democracy, things of that sort. Ironically, as soon as we created the Economic Freedom Index, rather than study democracy for the first, almost everybody started running growth regressions, started doing growth studies, looking at the relationship between economic freedom and growth. And so by this point in time now, some almost 20 years into the project, there are literally dozens of studies, several dozen, three or four dozen, 40, 50 studies that have looked at economic growth on the one hand and the impact of economic freedom on economic growth. And so we've got a lot of studies there now, and they're all a little bit different. They all use sometimes they use different sample sizes. Sometimes they look at just the developing countries. Sometimes they look at the developed countries, and they look at both sets at the same time. Sometimes they have longer time frames. Sometimes they have shorter time frames. So there are a lot of different varieties of studies of economic growth and economic freedom out there. But the good news is, it appears, if you try to summarize that literature, that economic freedom is a very, very strong correlate with economic growth. Just a few years ago, a few scholars in Scandinavia, Jacob de Haan, he's actually not Scandinavian, he's Dutch, and a couple of Swiss economists, co-authors, they did a survey of the literature of economic freedom and growth. They looked at all of these several dozen studies that looked at economic freedom and growth, and they concluded, and the quote is in front of you, they concluded that most of the studies that are looking out there show that the relation to economic freedom and economic growth, that these studies all seem to show a positive relationship with growth, and that none of them really show that economic freedom is bad for growth. So, you know, the best survey of the literature that we have, again, looking at several dozen different studies, shows that economic freedom is, in fact, not surprising probably to any of us, but is, in fact, a very strong predictor of growth. What I want to do, rather than summarize the overall literature, is I want to take you through the sort of specifics of one of those growth studies, a study that Jim Gourdney and Randall Holcomb and I did. Jim and of course, is a co-author on the index. Randy Holcomb may be known to you. He's a friend of the Mises Institute, and he's also a professor at Florida State University, former president of the Society for the Development of Austrian Economics, as well as a former president of the Public Choice Society. So Randy's quite a well-known scholar in our neck of the woods as well. And the three of us did a study that looked at economic freedom and growth. And I want to summarize that study because I think it's really representative of most of the other work that's out there. So let me step back a little bit and talk about growth theory in a more general sense. Basically, there are three broad theories that you'll see in economics about growth, why some countries grow more rapidly than others. The first theory is the sort of standard neoclassical theory. This is what you might call the solo growth model, after Robert Solow at Harvard. The solo or neoclassical approach essentially thinks of the economy as if it was a big factory. If we were thinking about it in microeconomic terms, what makes a factory more productive? Well, if you want to produce more in a factory, what you do is you add more inputs. If you want to produce more shoes, you bring into the factory more workers, more leather, more cloth, whatever you make the shoes out of. And it's simply a matter of applying more inputs and perhaps more technology to get more output. That the production process inside of a microeconomic firm is a physical process of simply combining inputs to get outputs. And that's essentially the approach that Solow and what we now call the neoclassical growth model says. So if you think about the economy as if it was a big factory, then the factory that is the economy, it will grow if we add more inputs. So growth is going to be a function of changes of inputs. It'll be a growth, the economy will produce more, it'll grow if we add more of its inputs. More people, more raw materials, more capital, or perhaps also changes in technology. So the simple neoclassical model is really just a derivation or a borrowing, if you will, of microeconomic theory about the firm, and they simply ramp it up and imagine that the economy is a big company. It's just a matter of inputs and outputs. Well, the obvious problem with the neoclassical theory is that if you look around the world, what you see is that many, many countries have large amounts of inputs available to them. They have large amounts of raw materials, plenty of people, plenty of access to technology, and so forth, and yet they produce very little. I mean, the Soviet Union was the classic example, but in modern times, you could look at countries like Argentina, which is fabulously rich in terms of its available inputs, but manages to produce relatively little. In contrast, there are countries out there that seem to be quite scant when it comes to natural resources or people. Countries like Hong Kong, which has little in the way of resources, yet produces a lot. So the neoclassical model on its own, with focusing on the role of inputs to create outputs and technology, it doesn't really seem to explain much of the pattern of economic growth around the world. So the second theory that you will encounter in the literature is what I just call a geography approach. It's quite clear if you look at the pattern of economic growth around the world, the countries that have grown the most rapidly over long time periods and have become richer, in fact, tend to be more northerly or more extremely southerly. The countries of Northern Europe, Canada, the United States, Japan, or on the other hand, if you look in the Southern Hemisphere, Australia, New Zealand, South Africa, or at least relatively speaking, that geography seems to have something to do with it. And so the scholars that have advanced the idea that geography matters, probably the best known a single scholar in this area is Jeffrey Sachs at Columbia. And Jeff Sachs has argued that the tropical locations of countries is a major deterrent to economic growth. Tropical locations, well, they're hot, and people don't work as efficiently or well when they're hot all the time, I suppose. But more importantly, tropical diseases such as malaria and such are more important in the tropics, and those diseases reduce the productivity of people and economies, reduce the incentive to invest, and so forth. Of course, Jared Diamond has also advanced a number of theories along similar lines. So the arguments by Sachs and Diamonds argue that countries that are in the tropics should be lagging behind in growth, and countries that the other argument that Sachs will argue is that having access to water transportation is also important. Landlocked countries may lag behind because they don't have good ocean transportation, and ocean transportation, as you probably know, is vastly cheaper than land transportation, as far as business services and trade is concerned. So Sachs and Diamond argue that geographic location or access to water geographically, these sorts of considerations are quite important. And if you look around the world, it's not obviously wrong. As I mentioned, the far northern hemisphere and the far southern part of the southern hemisphere, in fact, are on average richer, and they have over time grown more rapidly. But on the other hand, there are plenty of exceptions to the rule. There are the Hong Kongs of the world and Singapores of the world, which are borderline tropical, which have done very well. There are countries, Argentina again, which has access to water and is fairly southerly, subtropical, not tropical. It should be doing better. And so you see plenty of problems along those lines. And finally, of course, there is a whole school of thought going all the way back to Adam Smith and more modern times, including Douglas North or Milton Friedman, and for that matter, the Hayek and Mises, who have argued that what really matters for economic growth is institutions. Institutions matter. This is the institutions matter view. And the argument here is that public policies, such as tax policy, private property, trade policies, these things matter a lot. And it's in this context that the Economic Freedom Index can be useful as in terms of growth. It's worth noting that that all three of these predominant theories, they can be all correct. They're not mutually exclusive. It's entirely possible that neoclassical models make some sense, that countries that invest more in capital or human capital or physical capital, countries that invest in technological change, they may grow more rapidly. It's also entirely possible that countries that are not subject to tropical disease or countries that have access to cheap ocean transportation will grow more rapidly. It's also likely, it can possibly be true, the countries that have better institutions, private property, lower taxes, lower regulations, better monetary policies, that those institutions and policies also matter. So the three views are not mutually exclusive. And if you're going to study growth, you really have to take account of all of these competing arguments for economic growth. And for lack of any other technique, we have to go to statistics here. We have to look at statistical evidence and compare the growth records of countries over time, controlling for the various influences that might matter, to try to disentangle whether it's geography or whether it's inputs or whether it's institutions that matter the most. So let me look, and this looks much, much more complicated than it is, so please bear with me. It's really quite straightforward. What I want to sort of suggest to you is that we can think about economic growth as an equation. So G represents the growth rate of a particular country. And what we want to suggest is that the growth rate of a particular country is based in the neoclassical model on three simple variables. One is the level of income at the beginning of the period, GDP zero, so GDP at time zero. So if you were studying economic growth, say, from 1980 to 2000, you would include in the model some kind of accounting for the GDP in the beginning of the period in 1980. This is a straight derivation of the solo growth model. The argument here is that countries that have low GDPs at the start of the period should grow more rapidly. Countries that have high GDPs should grow less rapidly. This is the so-called convergence idea, that countries should converge over time. But really the important variables in the neoclassical standard growth approach are the investment in capital and the investment in human capital. So the INVK represents the investment in physical capital. It's classical gross capital formation. It's how much we invest in machinery, buildings, things of that sort. INVH represents the relatively recent influence of Gary Becker, suggesting that influence, that investment in human capital, education, and healthcare should also matter. If countries increase the education of their workforce, the livelihood of their workforce, that this should make the overall country more productive. So the standard neoclassical growth model includes basically some type of these three variables. Where did we start the period? What was our investment in capital, physical capital? How many new machines, how many new buildings, things like that? And how much did we invest in our human being capital? How much did we invest in healthcare and education, mainly? If you look at that model and you examine the patterns around the world, it turns out that we can explain about 30% or about a third of all of the variation of economic growth around the world is explainable with the standard model. So if you've had a course in statistics or econometrics, the R-squared, which really measures just sort of how good the model is in some overall sense, is about 30%. It can never be higher than 1, so this is 1/3. 0.1 is the highest possible R-squared, so 0.3 is essentially 30%. So the model is about 30% accurate, which isn't that bad. When I teach econometrics, I'm always cautioning students to not overestimate the importance of R-squared. However, you can look at R-squared in comparing models of the same type. So the second part of the process would be, what if we, starting with the neoclassical growth model, which is using GDP at the beginning of the period in investment, and what if we simply add in a few variables that Jeffrey Sachs likes to use, like whether the country is in the tropics or whether it has access to coasts? So all we're doing in the second part here is taking the original model and then adding in some tropical and coastal variables to try to figure out whether countries are growing more rapidly or less rapidly based on their geographic nature. If you just simply look at that, in terms of the overall fit, you increase the overall fit by about 10 percentage points, going from about 0.3 to about 0.4. Again, that's not that bad. But if you look at the third part here, what we're doing here is we're simply saying, okay, let's leave in the neoclassical model, let's leave in the Jeffrey Sachs model, and Let's now add in a few variables that account for the nature or the quality of the institutions. The Economic Freedom Index and also the change in the Economic Freedom Index. So if we were looking at growth over a long period of time, maybe 1980 to 2000, as I said, we would include the level of economic freedom, maybe the average over that period, and also the change, how the economic freedom changed during that period. And it turns out, just in terms of the R-squared, that adding in the institutional variables is quite a large bump in the overall explanatory power of the model. And you get to about a 60% explanatory power, in the statistical power. And that's about as good as you're going to get with a growth regression. If you think that's low, believe me, that's not low. It's pretty high. Okay, so that's basically the approach. We're going to try to figure out the patterns of economic growth around the world, looking at the neoclassical explanations here, looking at the coastal, the explanations for geography and tropics, and then also adding in and looking at the influence of institutions. So that's the basic approach. And let me sort of give you the standard result. So if you look at that last equation where we want to measure growth as some function of where the GDP level started, how much investment we've had, how much in capital, how much investment we've had in human capital, whether the country is tropically located, whether the country has access to the coasts, whether the country has a lot or a little economic freedom, and whether the country has changed its economic freedom in a positive or a negative way. Now, in terms of the predictions, we would expect B to be negative. The coefficient on that should be negative. This is the convergence idea. The idea here is that countries that start out high, rich, should grow less rapidly. Countries that start out poor should grow more rapidly. So we should expect a negative coefficient on GDP at the beginning of the period. So B should be negative. C and D are both positive values. And this is consistent with the neoclassical model. The neoclassical model says that more investment in capital, more investment in human capital should yield more growth. And so C is positive, D is positive. I should mention that D is frequently not robust. And what I mean by not robust, what I mean is that it's highly sensitive to the type of measure you use and also the types of other variables that you include in the model. So there's a huge consensus in the economic growth literature that investment in capital really matters. It is one of the most powerful predictors of economic growth around the world. Countries that have more investment in capital grow more rapidly. This is completely consistent with neoclassical theory, but for that matter, it's completely consistent with any theory that I think the Austrians would have about the long-run growth process. Capital development is clearly important, and statistics bear that out. Investment in human capital, it's not so clear. A lot of people firmly believe that investment in human capital is important, and generally speaking, it comes in with a positive sign, but as I mentioned, it frequently comes in with a very low value, sometimes even a negative value. It simply is very sensitive to the approach that the scholar uses when they do the study. But C is invariably positive. B is invariably negative. It doesn't really matter how you do the study. E is tropical location, and if Sachs is right, E should be negative. Being in the tropics should be bad for growth, so E should be a negative coefficient, and it usually is. In fact, Sachs is right there. I hate to admit that in public, but Sachs is absolutely correct that even when you control for other factors, countries that are located in the tropics do grow less rapidly. There is something to the story that malarial diseases, tropical diseases, heat, whatever you want to call it, there's something apparently to the story that tropics are bad in general. There isn't much to the story about coastlines. Having access to the coast, at least the way we measure it, does very rarely seem to have much influence. So that variable, at least for us, is typically around zero. And then for the institutions matter literature, the economic freedom variable G and the change in economic freedom coefficient H, they're both very positive, very robust, and I'll talk about how big they are right here in a second, but they're very, very solid. And this is what Jakob de Haan was looking at when he surveyed those several dozen studies, all of them doing variations on this equation. Again, sometimes they use different measures for that or different measures for that. Sometimes the time periods are different. Sometimes the countries they use are different. But invariably, as Jakob de Haan found, when people look at economic freedom and the change in economic freedom, that those are very strongly positive numbers. Let me talk about how positive they are. It's not just that the signs are positive, but they're actually quite large. The coefficient for G that Randy Holcomb and Jim Gortney and I have is about a 1. It's about 0.99, so essentially 1. And what that indicates is that countries that have 1 point higher economic freedom, and remember the economic freedom index is on a 10-point scale, so this would be like a country, compare a country that has a 6 rating versus a country that has a 7 rating. The argument that we get here is that a country that has a 7 economic freedom index should have about a 1 percentage point higher average annual growth rate than a country that has a 6 economic freedom rate. That one economic freedom point is purely coincidence, but it turns out it's worth about 1 annual rate of economic growth point. That's a big number. That's the difference in growing at 2% and 3%, or maybe 4% and 5%, but that's a very large number right there. Similarly large is the impact of a change in economic freedom. So here we'd be talking about a country that started at 6 at the beginning of the period and then changed its rating to, say, a 7. What we find is that that country is going to have its economic freedom, or excuse me, its economic growth benefit by about a 3/4 of a point. So that's quite a large effect. Just should mention that, you know, the United States has actually dropped by about a full point in economic freedom. So when people ask me, Lawson, you know, what's going to happen to the United States as the economic freedom index falls for the United States, I say, well, according to the evidence we have, the drop in the United States economic freedom rating of about 1 point should yield about 3/4 of a point of a lower economic growth, again, according to the model that we've constructed. You know, it could be wrong, of course, but that's basically the average result that we see from the evidence around the world. So that's the big story right there. And again, the good news is, from my point of view, or from a student of economic freedom's point of view, the good news is that this result is highly robust. No matter which of these variables you include, or which versions of these variables you include, which time periods, which set of countries, that you get numbers very close to this regardless. And that's a very comforting result for those of us who think economic freedom matters, but it's a very powerful result statistically. And Jakob de Haan, whose quote I mentioned at the beginning, is not a libertarian. He is not a free market economist. He's not a student of Ludwig von Mises. He's just a regular old economist. He's from Holland. He claims to be a social democrat. And yet he is completely convinced, as am I, and he's not convinced ideologically that economic freedom matters. He's convinced based on the evidence that he sees in the patterns of economic growth. So anyway, this is the standard result that we get from, again, the Gortney Holcomb Lawson study, which was an article in Kiklos, and I believe that was one of the studies that was put on your reading list. So you should have that if you want to read the full study. So that's the standard result. Now, before I go on, there's a question on the chat, and it's a little distracting from my point of view to look at the chat and try to talk, but I did notice that someone asked Daniel asked, whether by investment I mean just government or do you mean private investment. The investment number here is typically just private investment. Now, that's, I say typically because the accounting here is a little bit squirrely, but even in most countries, most of the investment is private, even in more government-oriented countries. So the number we have here is for total investment is mostly private, but it does include some public sometimes. And actually, that's the topic of the next discussion, part of the discussion. Let me actually go back. So what we find in this regression or this equation is that growth is powerfully influenced by basically a few factors. Investment, we can't really do anything about GDP, so let's not worry about that. But it's a factor, it's influenced by investment in capital, a little bit by tropics, but again, you can't do anything about that. And investment or economic freedom and change in economic freedom. But the variables that we really have something to do control over are investment in capital and economic freedom. Those are the variables we have some influence over as policymakers, as citizens, whatever. So it's these three variables that are really the variables that we have control over. But what we also should know is that investment in capital, which is a very powerful influence on growth, is also a function of economic freedom. I think we would argue that countries that have more economic freedom are going to grow more rapidly, but they're also going to invest more. So there's really two arguments here. One is that economic freedom creates growth, which we'll call the direct effect. Simply having more economic freedom, more private property, lower taxes, fewer regulations, and so forth, just makes the economy work better, increases the wheels of trade and exchange, increases incentives to be more productive, and on and on. And so growth is going to benefit directly from more economic freedom. But the other line of argument is that economic freedom is also going to generate more physical capital. In an economically free environment, people have stronger incentive to invest in capital, and that will have an indirect effect on growth. And we actually have a way in the paper of estimating both the direct and an indirect effect. And it turns out that if you include the direct effect and the indirect effect, the coefficients that we called G and H previously, G was the coefficient on the level of economic freedom and H was the coefficient on the change, but those coefficients get much larger. If you recall, the previous coefficient for G was 1, and now it's 50% larger. And the previous coefficient for H was 0.75, and now it's nearly doubled. So the impact of economic freedom that we see in the previous slide here in G and H, that impact is large on its own. But when you include the indirect influence of economic freedom, not just on growth directly, but also as it works through investments, it turns out we get a much larger effect. And that's a real powerful part of our study. I'm going to take a little bit of a digression here and just mention that there is a little bit of an argument about how we should look at economic freedom. Going back, if you look at the standard regression that I talked about a minute ago, we include the level of economic freedom, whether the country is a 6 or a 7, and then we also look at whether the country has changed its economic freedom. It started at a 6 and became a 7. And Jacob de Haan, again, this somewhat influential economist in Holland on these matters, he has argued that we should not look at the level, but we should only look at the change. He and I have had a bit of an argument about this, and in 2006, I wrote an article commenting on his argument. He then replied to my argument. I replied along with Julio Cole from Guatemala, Francisco Marroquin, and then they replied yet again. And the only thing we need to know is that I'm right and they're wrong. I'm joking here. But the point of the matter is that there is argument about the proper way to specify these sorts of equations, the proper way to model them, the proper modeling approach, the proper statistical approach, and so on. And even Jacob de Haan, whose literature I like and whose work I like and who I cite quite often, and Jacob de Haan, who is in fact quite convinced himself that economic freedom matters, he and I are having a bit of dispute about the nature of how this equation should be specified. Again, the good news is, I'm right and he's wrong, but the more important part of the story is that it doesn't really matter. If you believe I'm right, the bottom line is the same. Economic freedom matters. If you believe he's right, the bottom line is also the same. Economic freedom matters. We're simply having a sort of scientific debate about the approach. But the sort of conclusion, the general normative conclusion out of this is the same regardless of whether his approach is right or my approach is right. And I think that's something for people who are skeptical of statistics should think about. Yes, there is argument about how statistics should be used, what measures should be used, and so forth. But even when we have disagreements, we can sometimes, on the specifics of the statistics, we can sometimes reach agreement on the basic results. And here, Jacob de Haan and I are both in strong agreement that economic freedom is a very powerful predictor of growth. Again, this is not something that we should all be terribly surprised at, but again, it's not something that everyone knows automatically, apparently. All right. Before I go on, I'm going to look at a question here. Steve Wise, you ask if government investment would pull the coefficient downward, and that's an excellent question. I'm going to answer it now since I happen to see it on the chat. we actually, in the Kiklos study, and I do encourage you to read it, it is, a journal article, a moderately technical one, so if you're not well-schooled in econometrics, it might be difficult. But we actually do, in that paper, attempt to control for the distinction between government or public investment and private investment. That actually is very hard to do. Most of the accounting systems around the world do a very poor job of distinguishing between whether investment is done by governments or by private firms. And we have done our best, our level best, to try to capture, to try to account for that. And it turns out you're absolutely correct that government investment, the impact of government investment on growth is much lower than private investment. And so your instinct error is 100% correct. Unfortunately, the quality of the data there are sufficiently weak that it's just very hard to use those numbers. Your sample size goes down, the confidence in the figures goes down. But you're absolutely correct that we have evidence, and I think there's other evidence out there that shows that when you look at the public investment, that its impact on growth, while positive actually, is much lower than the impact of investment done by private firms. And that's, I think, a very powerful result that we get. I don't have a slide for that, but before I move on to other things, I want to be sure to mention that. So that's the economic freedom. That's the economic freedom and growth thing. And again, as I mentioned, most of the studies, I would say half at least of all the studies, and there's now some 400 studies are out there looking at economic freedom, maybe 100 of them that are really good statistical studies. I'd say about half of them are looking at economic freedom and growth. But there are a lot of other studies that look at economic freedom and something else, some other outcome. And before I conclude today, I wanted to go through some of the other studies that are out there. And I don't have full citations on these slides, but if you're very interested in the exact citation, I'd be happy to give you perfect, more credible citations. So let's look at some other economic freedom research. So research that looks at the impact of economic freedom and on other things. The first one I want to mention is something by Bill Easterly. If you don't know who Bill is, Bill is a professor at NYU, and his sort of claim to fame is that he and Jeffrey Sachs are sort of mortal enemies. They sort of hate each other. Jeffrey Sachs, as you know, is constantly advocating for more government support for poverty programs around the world and such. Easterly is a steadfast opponent of foreign aid. And he has an article in 2005, which actually appeared in the 2005 Economic Freedom Index. So if you're interested in seeing the article, just simply go to the Economic Freedom website and look at the 2005 report, and you'll see Easterly's article in there. In that article, what he finds is that if you control for initial income and economic freedom, that foreign aid actually has no effect on growth. And in fact, foreign aid is negative. And on growth. What we find is that if you look, what happens in real life is that foreign aid tends to go to countries that have very poor economic freedom ratings. And the aid actually correlates with negative economic growth. So for all of us who have our suspicions about foreign aid, the empirical literature, it's not just Bill Easterly, it's dozens of studies here, the empirical literature is completely on our side that foreign aid has been an absolute disaster as far as creating economic growth. It's actually had a negative impact, if anything. And Easterly's been the sort of leading advocate for this point of view. Jeffrey Sachs ignores this evidence, to be perfectly honest, and argues that the reason foreign aid hasn't worked is because we haven't done enough. It's very much like Krugman's arguments for stimulus. We haven't done enough. Again, looking at the chat here, most of this aid is public aid. There's very, very, I mean, quantitatively speaking, there's very little private aid. I mean, there is private aid that goes out, and the United States is a major contributor towards private aid flows, but quantitatively speaking, the volumes of aid around the world are almost all public, and there's just, it's a trivial sum relative to the total that's private. So the aid numbers that we're looking at here are all public, And there is evidence, there is data on private aid, but it's very, the amount is very small, and the statistics there aren't as well kept as the public aid. But we're talking about public foreign aid here. Probably my favorite study that's ever been done with the Economic Freedom Index is by Eric Gartsky. Eric is a professor at the University of California, San Diego. And he is a researcher who studies peace. Specifically, he studies the likelihood of countries going to war, among other things. He studies this. So what he does is he looks at all the countries in the world. He looks at them in pairs. So if you have 100 countries in the world, there's 100 times 99 country pairs. Each country could have a war with, each one country could have a war with 99 other countries. So he looks at the probability that any two countries will have a war. And there are a lot of predictions that you can, a lot of statistics you can do in here. You can predict whether two countries will likely have a war with each other. For a very long time in political science, and Gartsky is a political scientist, not an economist, for a long time in political science, the standard argument for war, or for the likelihood of war, is that democracies don't fight wars frequently or as frequently, and in fact, democracies don't fight wars with other democracies. And in the political science literature, this has come down to be known as the democratic peace thesis, the argument that democracies are less warlike than autocratic or totalitarian regimes. And in political science, this is considered sort of an article of faith, that democracy is fundamentally contributes to peace, less war. Well, what Eric Gartsky takes note of is that, well, most countries that are democracies have a fairly high degree of economic freedom, not all, but many. And most countries that have economic freedom are democracies. And so what he looks at is whether or not we have perhaps misidentified the peacefulness of democracies, whether or not really it was economic freedom that makes them more peaceful. And in fact, that's what he finds. If you do a sort of horse race statistical test between democracy and economic freedom, it turns out that when you look at economic freedom and democracy, democracy's influence is very, very small. But economic freedom's influence is quite large. And this is a derivation from the paper. If you look at the lowest free countries, they've got a 7% chance of having a military dispute with somebody else in the world. Countries, I think he used the bottom 10% of the economic free countries. So if you were in the bottom 10% of the Economic Freedom Index, you have about a 7% chance of having a military dispute over his time period that he studied. While the free states have about a half of 1%. The countries in the top 10% of the Economic Freedom Index have about a half of 1%. So that's a 14-to-1 difference in the likelihood of having a military dispute with another country based on whether you're at the top versus the bottom of the economic freedom. The difference for democracy is basically zero. When you look at the top or the bottom of democracies, it turns out there isn't much of a difference of their likelihood of having a military dispute, again, after you control for economic freedom. This turns out to have been a bit of a problem for Gartsky because, as I mentioned, it's an article of faith in political science circles that democracies are fundamentally peaceful. This democratic peace idea is deeply embedded in the political science community. Gartsky writes this paper in 2005, which was published in the very top political science journal, and he creates a bit of a firestorm in that he argued that his article was called The Capitalist Peace, and in that article he again argued that capitalism and freedom was more important, and he got attacked quite viciously by the political science community. He was tenure-track professor at Columbia, and I think he lost his job because of his politically incorrect finding. Now, he ended up finding a job at UC San Diego, which is a top program, but I think that Gartsky was quite brave to stand up to his political science colleagues and argue that his colleagues were wrong in thinking that democracies were fundamentally peaceful, when in fact it was economic freedom that was driving the result. So it's a favorite study of mine. I think it's fundamentally important for us to remember that economic freedom is not just about higher growth rates. It's also about things that are deeply important, like the frequency or the likelihood of having military conflict. Now, I imagine some of you are familiar with these two economists, Russell Sobel, who's a professor at West Virginia University, and Pete Leeson, who's a professor at George Mason University. They wrote an article in 2006, and this was when Pete Leeson was still at West Virginia. Pete, of course, is the pirate economist. He wrote the article about the book about the political economy of pirates, which you may have heard of. Anyway, they wrote an article looking at whether or not capitalism, or if you will, economic freedom, is contagious. What they were interested in is whether or not countries that have economic freedom, if there's a spillover to their neighboring countries. So does country A, if it has a lot of economic freedom, does that mean that the neighboring country B catches some of it? Does it spill over? The argument is, the study that they did is quite sophisticated. It relies on something called spatial econometrics, which allows you to sort of look at how the influence of a variable spills over to another place. What they find is that about 20% of economic freedom spills over. So if you think about it, if France increases economic freedom rating by 1 point, then if its neighbors, Spain, Germany, Netherlands, Luxembourg, Italy, and Switzerland, and Belgium, increase economic freedom by 1 point, then France's rating would increase by 0.2 points. That turns out to be statistically significant, but really quite small. Relatively small. I mean, for France and Germany, for Spain and Germany and Netherlands and Luxembourg, Italy, Switzerland, and Belgium, all to increase their economic freedom by a full point, that's a big deal. And only 0.2 would be captured by France. That's a pretty small statistical effect. And so the conclusion that Leeson and Sobel have in this paper is that free markets do spread around the world. That if countries are free, it does spread, or if countries are not free, it spreads. But that the spread is quite small. And this really, they use this article as a segue to talk about the sort of domino theory that we talked about back in the Cold War, the argument that democracies would spread around the world. What they find is that not with democracy, but at least with economic freedom, is that that doesn't spread much. You can increase the economic freedom of a particular country, and only a tiny bit of that goes to the neighboring countries. And so if you think about this in a foreign policy context, one of the arguments that George W. Bush used, for example, for why we need to invade Iraq is so we can get Iraq a good democracy, and a good market economy, and that'll help spread democracy and freedom around the Middle East. Well, statistically, Sobel and Leeson don't find a lot of support for the argument that's going to be successful. And so that's the important results in their study. All right, so one other study that's been done, and there's only been a few studies that look at equality. Mainly this is because income inequality data for the world are really, really bad. There are so many different technical details for how you collect the data. I mean, we're having an argument in the United States alone about whether income inequality is increasing or decreasing. We have the data. Some people think income inequality is increasing. Some people think inequality is not increasing. The argument is very technical. It's detailed arguments about the nature of households, demographic changes, all kinds of arguments like that. If you think about it, we don't really have a good handle in the United States of what's happening to income equality. Imagine what kind of handle we have on that data for 100 countries. It's really pretty bad. Now, that hasn't stopped economists from trying to look at it. Now, there are a few attempts to try to capture good, consistent economic or income equality data for a large number of countries. Gerald Scully, who was a professor at the University of Texas, Dallas, who unfortunately died a few years ago, and the world's quite it's a big loss for economics because Jerry Scully was a great economist. But he did one of the first studies that looked at economic freedom and income equality and economic growth. And what he finds is that there is a small trade-off between growth and income equality, but economic freedom promotes income equality. He doesn't find any support in his study for the idea that economic liberalism is going to harm income equality. I mean, most people, at least most people on the left, firmly believe that market-oriented economies are going to have more income inequality, and the answer is simply not necessarily the case. Now, I should be fair, there are two or three other studies. At least one study contradicts Jerry's study. So there is some dispute on this question. I think that the bottom line is that when it comes to income equality and economic freedom, there is some evidence that there is no conflict between economic freedom and income equality. There is some evidence there might be. The evidence is weak because the nature of the data sets that we have available are weak, and we don't really know. The good news is, here again, is it's certainly not a slam dunk case. It is certainly not obvious, as many people believe it is, that economic freedom harms income equality. In general, in fact, as Scully shows, in fact, it's probably the other way around. Now, I almost hesitate to talk about this one because I'm not sure I believe it's true, but Marshall Stocker, who is actually a financial analyst, he's also a friend of the Mises Institute. I believe he's participated in a number of the programs in Auburn. Marshall has a paper that looks at stock returns around the world. And what he finds is that increases in economic freedom, not so much the level of economic freedom, but changes in economic freedom, in fact, increase equity returns. And he argues that an investment strategy based on economic freedom would earn abnormally high returns. Now, I'm not sure I believe that this is true. I hate to say it, but I'm something of a sympathetic to the so-called efficient markets hypothesis. But there is some evidence from Stocker that this is true. There are a couple actual funds that you can buy into that claim to use either the Heritage or our Fraser Institute Economic Freedom Index as the basis for making investment choices within the mutual funds. And of course, the mutual fund managers of those funds are claiming that economic freedom is a useful way to choose stocks. And should get you better returns. I don't know that I believe it's the case. Certainly, I'm not making investment advice here. But there is some scholarly work being done to look at whether or not economic freedom, or at least changes in economic freedom, are influential as far as stock returns are concerned. All right, that's actually the last slide that I have prepared. We've got about 50 minutes. I think there's probably quite a few questions that I have provoked. I see that there's been continuing chats here, so I haven't been paying close attention. But if there's any questions that anybody has, we'd like to send it over the chat. I'd be happy to try to answer your questions. Yeah, I don't really have much to say more than this, so you're going to need to answer some questions here. Otherwise, we're going to be done a little early tonight. Oh, I see one. Okay. Okay, so Mark, your question is about the optimal way to run a welfare system. Yeah, okay. Wow. I have to say, I do agree with you. We're not going to have an ideological revolution anytime soon. and we are sort of stuck with the welfare state that we have. I think there are clearly, within the bounds of reality, there are clearly better ways and worse ways to do things. In the recent weeks, I've been doing some academic reading on the area of governance or the quality of government. I think there's a fundamental relationship between economic freedom and the quality of government. By quality of government, I'm talking about how efficient the public service is, how efficient civil servants are, how trustworthy they are, whether they're corrupt, whether they are unbiased in their decision-making, impartial in their decision-making, these kinds of things. And I think that there's a relationship between economic freedom and the quality of our government, not the quantity of our government, but the quality of the government. Generally speaking, I think that when government gets big, the quality goes down as well, because when governments get big, there are pressures by us, by you and me, and by everybody else, to try to get around that government some way or another, and that puts pressure on the public servants to accept bribes, or not even to accept bribes, but to simply play favorites with some groups or other groups and so forth. So I do believe that it's better to have a quality government, regardless of whether we have a big government or a small government, and my preference is for a smaller government. But if we have a large government, we're better off, you and I are better off with a government that is higher quality, where the civil servants are more impartial in the decisions that they make, where the civil servants do not play favorites and so forth. Now, as you know, that's pretty hard to pull off. When the government gets big, they start to play favorites. But to the extent possible, that would be a desirable approach. I mean, I think if you look at the Scandinavian countries like Sweden and Norway and Finland and such, they have very large governments, but they also have extremely well-governed governments. The public servants, the civil servants in Sweden are highly professional. They are highly impartial in the way in which they apply rules and regulations and so forth. They are not just complete evil favor pushers. I mean, they actually do have discretion, but they are very good, I think, about applying the laws in reasonable ways. And I think one of the reasons why the Scandinavian countries, despite their large governments, do so well is because their governments are high quality. They have high quantity, but also high quality, and that helps. One of the worries for countries like the United States is that I don't think the quality of our government is all that good. And now that the government has gotten bigger quantitatively, we're going to have sort of the worst of all worlds. So a large government, but also a large government that is poorly run in terms of its impartiality and so forth. I think part of the answer to the question is, to the extent possible, emphasis, if we can't do anything about the size of government, perhaps we can do something about the quality of the government, more resources devoted towards convincing civil servants to be better at their jobs. Their jobs are, they're doing too much, but at least the jobs they're having, they should be doing better. That's a weak answer, but I think it's the best answer I have. I'm sorry, I'm reading the question, so give me a second here. Mark has a question about if you move from Hong Kong to the United States, would a person notice a huge difference in terms of personal economics? Actually, I think the answer is not a huge difference, but it would be noticeable. If you wanted to start a business in Hong Kong, particularly if it has any kind of health or safety implication, you're going to find it far, far easier to do so in Hong Kong. If you want to open up a restaurant in Hong Kong, for example, it's going to be far simpler, far less onerous than in the United States. So I think the answer is you definitely notice it. Would you think it's huge or not? I don't know. But it would be very noticeable. I think that in it depends a lot on which areas you're in. If you were running a software firm in the United States versus Hong Kong, I doubt that you would notice much different at all. If you were running a restaurant or a pharmaceutical company, something that has health, safety, or environmental concerns, which is where the U.S. has really become quite difficult in a regulatory sense, then I think you'd notice a big, very large difference. The chat's going so fast that I'm having trouble keeping up with it, so hold on just a second. I'm sorry. Daniel asks, if tomorrow we allow freely competing currencies, cut $1 trillion from the debt, abolish the income tax, and do the simple sales tax or something, how much would that push our economic freedom up? It would help. On the currency thing, the U.S. gets a pretty high rating now, even though we don't have freely competing currencies. It would not go up much because of the way we do it in terms of the structure of the index. $1 trillion in debt would have some influence, but mostly you'd have to cut spending to do it. If you simply raise taxes to cut the debt, that would not actually help the index. Replacing the income tax and replacing with a simple sales tax, again, what would really matter for us in the index would be whether or not that was a cut or an increase or a stay of the same on spending. If it was a simple change of income or simple replacing of the sales tax, of the income tax with a sales tax, raising the same amount of revenue, we would score that the same. We're not really terribly invested in the battle about sales versus income taxes, at least as far as the index is concerned. So actually, doing what you say there, probably unless we cut government spending, probably wouldn't do much. The real problem for the U.S. score has been in the property rights area, and that's a much harder thing for them to fix, at least in the short run. Steve Wise, you have a question about corruption, and that's a good question. In the equations we have, we could include corruption as an additional explanatory factor. We don't do that normally. You can do that. There are plenty of studies that look at the impact of corruption on that. The problem we would have, at least I would have with that, is that amount of corruption is really so closely related to economic freedom that if you included the corruption in there, you'd be capturing economic freedom. So you'd be stealing some of the strength from economic freedom, which is okay, but that would be the issue. There are a few studies, there's five or six studies that look at the impact of economic freedom and corruption. They all show that economic freedom, more economic freedom, better economic freedom scores mean less corruption. And so corruption is bad for growth. Economic freedom is good for growth. Economic freedom, corruption are negatively correlated. So they're really all sort of in the same sort of ball of ideas. But we don't really look at it in the equations ourselves. Again, if you send me an email or something, I can find a citation on some of the corruption stuff that's out there. There's a few studies. There's an index of corruption called the Transparency International Index, which is quite popular. Matthew asks, how much do inflation rates and increases in money supply count towards the level of economic freedom? Well, structurally speaking, it's about 20% of the index. We have five areas. One of those five areas is sound money. There are four variables in that area, but all of them are basically measured. Three of them are measures of inflation and money supply growth. They're different types of approaches. They're all trying to measure inflation and money supply growth. Then the fourth one actually looks at whether you're allowed to hold foreign currency. So That's whether you're free to choose your currencies or not. So, Matthew, the short answer to your question is 20%. Now, I don't know if that's enough for your tastes or not. Some people would probably want it to be higher, but some people would think it's too much. I don't really know. Mark, do I see the economic future of the U.S. as being as doom and gloom as other Austrians? Probably not. I'm probably not as gloom and doom as other Austrians. But having said that, I probably have never I'm 44 years old. I've been a professional economist. I got my degree at 24. So this is 20 years as a professional economist. I have never been as pessimistic about the future of the United States economically as I am right now. And I'm sort of a perpetual optimist. I mean, for years and years, I would say quite charitable things about the United States economy. One of the things about studying economic freedom around the world is that the more you learn about the rest of the world, the better the U.S. looks. And so when I was a young, fire-breathing student of you know, Mises and Rothbard and Milton Friedman, if I can use all those terms in the same sentence without getting in trouble, when I was a young, fire-breathing libertarian, I thought the U.S. was a socialist going on the verge of you know, socialism. But as I studied economic freedom for, you know, the next decade or so, and when you study, you know, Congo and Myanmar and Namibia and Venezuela and so forth, what you start to get is a sort of grudging admiration for the amount of economic freedom, not as much as I would like, but the amount that we have in the United States. So for most of my career, I've been quite charitable to, and I would applaud the fact that the United States has been able to pull off a fairly high degree of economic liberalism for many people for a long time. But I can tell you, I am about as down on the U.S. as I've ever been. The trends are so negative. And they're in some deeply fundamental areas. And again, that property rights area number is so deeply fundamental to the operation of an economy that no country performs well in the whole world if it doesn't have good property rights. And our numbers are going down there. And maybe those numbers are somewhat, maybe they've gone down too much. Maybe the data we have are overreacted. But doggone it, that's a really worrying thing. I actually worry about that more than this tax stuff. I mean, I know that spending's out of control, but we can undo spending. And we're going to have to. We don't have a choice on that. We can't tax our way out of this. We're going to have to cut spending. But I'm more worried about the property rights regime and the amount of corruption that seems to have filtered into the U.S. system. That's got me really down. So I'm not as bad as most Austrians probably, but I've never myself been as bad as I am right now. Cheryl Laszlo asks if the borders in Hong Kong are fairly free and is it easy to immigrate? You know, I don't really know the answer to that question. I suspect the answer is it is not that easy to immigrate into Hong Kong. I know that Chinese people from mainland China are not permitted to freely immigrate or emigrate from China into Hong Kong. Whether or not Hong Kong has a relatively liberal immigration regime vis-a-vis other countries, I don't really know the answer to that question. I think historically they were pretty open, but I suspect that they've closed a bit too. I just don't really know the answer to that. And the follow-up is, is protecting borders an important part of economic freedom? My answer is yes, or excuse me, let me go back. My answer is no. I'm probably going to get in trouble here with this group, but I'm an unapologetic open borders person. I assign absolutely no meaning, economically, moral, or otherwise, to lines that politicians draw on maps. I think to the extent people are able to move peacefully and freely, they should be allowed to do that, whether they cross a line on a map or not. Now, that's my personal view. But I should mention it has nothing to do with the Economic Freedom Index, because we don't really have data on the impact of visa, or excuse me, the impact of immigration restrictions. At the end of this course, the very last lecture or talk or whatever it is, discussion, I'm going to talk about travel visas, not immigration, but simple travel around the world. So I am interested in that. I think it's important for economic freedom. When you say protecting borders, I assume you're talking about keeping immigrants out. I personally am not. I think when the government keeps immigrants out, that's just as much a violation of freedom as when they keep goods out. That's my personal view. I understand that there's disagreement among that with some people. So I side with Walter Block on that and against Hoppe. So, well, hey, everybody agrees. That's good. there's two levels to that debate. One is the argument about the moral argument. The other is the empirical argument. I mean, there is some disagreement about the impact of immigrants on society in an empirical sense. And I happen to think it's not that large, one way or the other. But that's a separate argument as well. Mark, that's a deep question, buddy. If the world reenters a multipolar geopolitical world, I had to think for a second about what you mean by that, but I think I know. Would that help or hurt economic freedom? Honestly, I don't know. I got a suspicion it might. I don't know. Yeah, that's a great question. I actually think that the hegemony of the United States or in the world in the last 50 years has been good for economic freedom around the world. I think that the market-oriented United States was a beacon and the most politically important, militarily important country in the world, for better or worse. I think it was actually good for economic freedom around the world. I think countries tried to the extent possible, emulate that. I think the U.S. was the leader for global reductions in tariffs and quotas around the world. Again, not as much as any of us would like, but they're absolutely important reductions in tariffs and quotas around the world that we were the leader on. If we get into a more multipolar political environment, I worry about it in a number of dimensions. It's not because I want the U.S. to be the single pole, but you know, in a world where we've had multipolar powers, sometimes that doesn't end well. It didn't end well in Europe in 1914, or 1939, for that matter. So sometimes those multipolar worlds end up in deep competitions for power. And that competition with government, unlike markets, competition between governments sometimes is violent. And that's a worry. That having said that, I don't think the U.S. has to be the leader. I mean, and there are certainly negative parts of that too. The wars that the U.S. has fought around the world, and I mean, there's both pluses and minuses. I honestly. Mark, as a follow-up, I think you're right. Competition between countries does in fact encourage them to have more economically optimal choices. I'm a firm believer in competition between governments, but it's not political competition that I'm talking about. It's economic competition. It's competition for capital. So I do believe that a world where China is a powerful economy is good for the United States, partly because if they become economically powerful, that means they're going to produce a lot. We can buy their stuff, and that's good for us. When people make stuff, we can buy it. It's good for us. It's not bad for us. But the other argument is that if there's another regime out there that's attractive to capital, it will encourage our country to be more attractive for capital. So there is such a thing as intergovernmental competition for capital that I think is very important and very powerful force for economic liberalism. And so, yes, I completely agree with that. But I worry, though, about competition for capital, I think, is great. If when you talk about competition between governments for political hegemony, for political influence around the world, that's where I worry. And unfortunately, you get both. Okay, so yeah, I'm a big believer and big fan of intergovernmental competition. I wrote my dissertation on intergovernmental competition, actually. So I'm very much a fan of the concept. I think it's really a powerful force. Yeah, Cheryl, you're absolutely right. Thank you for bringing that up. Partly economists are interested in income equality because that's the data we have. But you're absolutely right. Even if we had equal incomes, we would all find ways to draw distinctions amongst ourselves, and we would compete on margins, different margins. If you really want to have everyone be equal, that is a world that it looks like Harrison Bergeron, if you've read the Kurt Vonnegut story. So that's a never-ending cycle. People are unequal, not just in their incomes, we're unequal in our intellects, our speed, our heights, our attractiveness. Maybe in some science fiction world, you could imagine us having to wear, pretty people have to wear bags over their heads, something like that. I mean, it is I think it's a fool's errand to pursue equality in the way in which the left wants to pursue it. Income equality, I think, is the dominant one because that's where most of the action is. Now, while we're talking about Harrison Bergeron, if you haven't seen the movie version, it's a very short movie that was done a few years ago. I think you should look it up. It's called I forget. Anybody remember the name of the movie? 2081. Yeah, it's a short movie. A great movie. 2081. So if you haven't seen the short movie, get that. It's quite good. Are there any numbers on bartering between neighbors and friends increasing in socialist countries to avoid excessive taxes? Daniel, I don't know. I don't know of any numbers on that. Anecdotally, of course, I think we all see evidence of that, but honestly, in terms of empirical work, I don't think I've seen anything on that. There is a little bit of work on remunerations where people send money back home, like American, Mexican immigrants in the United States send money home to Mexico, or Armenian immigrants in Fresno, California, send money home to Armenians, but not a lot of work that I've seen on that. It does make sense, yeah, I agree. But yeah, Cheryl, I don't know if that's 30-40% of Italy's economy is in the black market. That's probably a little high. There are some pretty good estimates, actually, about the size of the black market economy. If anybody's interested in this, you should look up a fellow by the name of Friedrich Schneider. That's his name. And there are a number of techniques that statisticians have for looking at whether or not the economy is actually larger than reports that be. Just one example, one of the things we can measure pretty well is electricity production, and there's a pretty good correlation between electricity production and output. And what you see in some countries, there's way too much electricity production, way not enough output. So what that indicates is that there's a lot of black market activity. So there are a few approaches out there like that. And Friedrich Schneider is kind of the go-to guy around the world. So he actually has tables for the whole world that look at the estimated size of the underground or shadow economy. And I don't know how high it is for Italy in his tables, but I think for the United States the figure was in the order of 20%. Mark, do I see a tipping point in the data when countries get much better or much worse? No. No, actually, we've looked for discontinuities or, you know, pivots in the data or, you know, and it doesn't really, we've not been able to find anything like that. It looks like it's a pretty stable thing. I mean, as you go from more economic freedom to less, growth falls and other outcomes get worse. But it doesn't look like there's a particular magic inflection point or anything like that, at least not that we've been able to discern in the data. We've looked for that a little bit, and others have too. And essentially, it's a good question, but it doesn't look like there's much of that. We seem to be running out of questions. Is there any more questions? Which measure on the index do I think we have the most hope of making gains going forward? Well, if you look at the index, again, the things that you can change quickly are things like spending. Some of the regulatory things can be changed quickly. I think the damage, again, I keep going back to the property rights question, the damage done to the perception, at least, that property rights are less secure in the United States, that damage is going to be much slower to repair, but maybe I'm wrong there. But it looks like that's a slower thing. Certainly, we can reverse the spending course pretty quickly. It won't be easy to do it, but I mean it's technically possible to cut spending. I mean it's something you can just do. I mean reforming property rights is just like, that's really hard. I mean that, I don't know how. There's no trigger to pull there. Congress is going to have to cut spending. They don't have a choice. Put three or four changes to make her president. Daniel, I don't know. If I was president, I'd legalize drugs. It's not even in the index. I'd open borders. I'd never be president, obviously. But legalizing drugs and opening borders. It would help more people more quickly than any other thing I know, especially low-income people. Low-income people are under assault in this country because of the war on drugs. And if you really care about people, I care every bit about it, Mexican people as American people. And if you really want to help people, we can help a lot of people quickly by letting them come to this country. Those are the two things I do. And neither one of those are measured in the index. It wouldn't help our economic freedom index, but it would help a lot of people. The question is about quality of government from Alicia. Thank you. When I say quality of government, I'm really thinking of the ability of civil servants, whether you're talking about people at the DMV or police or judges or whatever, to apply the laws impartially, to not play favorites, to not say, yeah, I know the law says X, but you're a friend of mine, you're in my tribe, your cousin's married to my sister or something, that we'll let you out of it. Quality government is about that impartiality aspect. I think quality governments tend to be small because it's easier to be quality when you have a small government, but independently I think we should think about the size of the government separate from the quality of the government, and that's the approach there. Scandinavian governments have high quality, relatively speaking, and it is odd that their governments are big. They're able to pull that off. Most countries can't pull that off, or haven't been able to anyway. Would I give immigrants the right to vote? I don't. I don't really care if they vote. I probably wouldn't, I guess, if I was God. But if they did vote, I don't think it'd be much worse than what we got now, to be honest with you. I don't have a lot of faith in voters that are born on this side of the line on the map. Adding a few million voters who were born on the other side of the map probably wouldn't be any worse. Okay, Mark, you asked, what are the worst abuses of property rights? You know, that's one of the problems with the index, is that we see the index numbers for property rights security going down, but we don't have a good handle on exactly what the nature of the abuses are, because they're survey-based questions. I think it's a lot of little things. Yeah, the property rights is a survey. We use three different surveys, so it's not like it's just one methodology, but they're basically subjective surveys. And they're not very specific to what they're talking about. I think asset forfeiture is a good, you know, warrantless searches, knockless, search, you know, not having to knock at the door before you can bang it in, search for drugs. I think the Kelo decision, the Supreme Court Kelo decision, was a very noticeable event in people's minds. Maybe that's not that important to most people, but I think it was something that most people took notice of, so that probably influenced the surveys. I think having to take your shoes off at the airport, for that matter, is part of it. The Kelo decision. I'll write it down here. This was the eminent domain decision. And the lady's name was Sarah Kelo. She sued because they were taking her house to build a shopping mall or something. And they actually never did build a shopping mall, but anyway, she lost the case at the Supreme Court. So the government took her property just to give it to some rich guy. The Supreme Court backed up the government and the rich guy. That happens more than a few times. Yeah. So I think it's a lot of these sorts of things. I don't think there's a real good handle on and which ones are most important in people's minds. That's unfortunate. I wish I knew more about that. Well, okay, folks, I think we're just about out of time. I'm about out of energy here. So I think we'll go ahead and start closing it up. If anybody has a email question or something like that, feel free to shoot me one. Otherwise, I will see you all next week. I think next week's topic is, if I remember right, it's on economic freedom and human rights violations. And we get to pick on what's her name? Naomi Klein, which is always fun. So I'll see you next week. Thanks.